Culture presentation.
Welcome back to The Cast of Us, an untitled HBO The Last of Us podcast. I am one of your hosts, Matt Rohrbeck. Alongside, he's not allergic to mushrooms, but he is, I was going to say mushroom meter approved, Eric Marchin.
Could you imagine that? I mean, like, who would be the top?
Mushroom meter?
The mushroom meter.
Eric, it's definitely not, you know, 2 years later. It's definitely still 2023 as we're recording this. It's only been, you know, 1 week since episode 7 of season 1 of The Last of Us. Yeah. How are you doing?
Well, I mean, how was you're not going to Florida yet, are you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I just got back from Florida. Yeah, I went to Orlando with my family. It is
smooth, right?
February of 2023. That's 100%. Yeah. No, I said we weren't going to reference this, but yes, we are back. And I just want to kind of explain our absence very quickly. There might even be some people who are jumping in, not even realizing this, depending on when you're listening this. Eric and I did this little show called The Cast of Us, where we did episode recaps of HBO The Last of Us during its first season. Then in February of 2023, we did episode 7. I went to Florida. I got back from Florida and then had a mental breakdown. I'm very okay now. I'm in a good headspace. You know, we took a hiatus from this show and our main show, the Untitled Movie Podcast.
Please, I never left.
Yeah, you never left, but I did take a little bit of a leave of absence. And then this show kind of unfortunately got kind of put on the back burner because season 1 of The Last of Us had ended. You know, I wasn't in the right headspace to do anything. And then it always was something where like, hey, we should go back to that. Cause like, I really enjoyed doing those first, 7 episodes. I think it was one of our most popular shows because we were very hyper-focused on one show that both, I really loved from the video game and you were coming in fresh, not having played the game at all. And, it was always something like we should do that. We should do it before it wins its Emmys or we should do it during this time. And then like it never happened. And now we were like, all right, The Last of Us is returning for season 2. I'm like, let's go back and do these final 2 episodes of season 1 and continue it with season 2. So that's what we're going to be doing today. We will be reviewing and recapping episode 8 of season 1 of The Last of Us. And I'm excited to be back. That's my little intro, Eric. How have you been these last couple years for people who don't listen to our other show?
Well, you know what? Pretty much stayed the course, you know, doing a lot of reviews. My grandfather died. That was great.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know, so life in general, I think it's one of those situations where, you know,
I went back to school. Yeah. You know, like lots of shit has happened.
We've grown since then, like a fungus, and spread whatever they grow.
And we're just being your method, right? Because there is going to be a 5-year gap in between seasons 1 and seasons 2 of The Last of Us. That's not a spoiler, but we'll get there when we get there. But
we needed to take the time to get ready for the electric state.
Yeah.
And what that movie had to give us. In combination with the Russo brothers revealing the cast of Avengers Doomsday. So that's, you know, we're looking
at all dating this episode now, and now it's not timeless at all. It's definitely not March 5th, 2023, as we're recording this. Okay. Episode 8, When We Are in Need, directed by Ali Abbasi, definitely had not directed The Apprentice.
Got in trouble with sexual assaults and other things. So, wow. Funny how time works.
Yes. So, anyways, we'll leave that there. So, but yes, he does direct episodes 8 and 9. So episode 7, like we said, it's been a few years for us, but I'm very familiar with the game and the show. I've watched the show now 2 or 3 times all the way through. Episode 7 ended with Joel getting injured, I believe, at the school.
Yes, he was stabbed.
At the university with Ellie. You seemingly don't know if Joel survived or is killed in that moment. And then that's kind of the cliffhanger at the end of episode 7, I believe. Do we see Ellie at the end of, or she's like kind of tending to Joel at the end and you don't know if he's going to survive?
Yeah, well, she's kind of trying to get out of the situation because you still have other members of this unidentified group that we don't know who they are yet. Mm-hmm. Also at this school lab testing site, and she's getting out of there. And so I think she's right now searching for cover and trying to figure out like what the next step is, because they're on their way to the Fireflies at this point.
Exactly. So this episode begins kind of in a snowy kind of a town. We see kind of a group of survivors in this kind of makeshift. It's a resort that they're staying at. They're kind of in a lodge at the beginning. And we see a man named David, played by, is it Scott Shepherd?
Scott Shepherd, yeah. Character actor Scott Shepherd, yep.
Playing David, who is kind of a religious figure to them, kind of almost like a pastor or kind of a preacher, who's reading kind of scripture to these people. We see kind of his second in command, James, who is played by Troy Baker, who is actually the original voice of Joel from The Last of Us video game. There's kind of these heavy religious kind of undertones in this sequence. And then we get the details of that. A girl and I think her mother and a young girl are grieving their father, who was recently killed, and kind of David, kind of deflects away from their thing. So we're introduced to this new set of characters. I kind of really like this of it. It's not necessarily a bottle episode like the episode 3, but I do like that it's kind of feels self-contained. Like this arc in the game, because the game kind of takes its time and takes a lot longer, doesn't feel as maybe short as this episode, but I kind of like how much they kind of, you know, from start to beginning, give you David's story and those survivors in this episode. So we kind of see them talking about how these men went out to go look for deer and never came back. And ultimately they realized that they were killed and that they're kind of struggling to find food at this time. Right, Eric?
Yeah, it's all about famine, right? Like Scott Shepherd's creepy clergyman will send chills down your spine. And you know, as you find out in the story that he used to be a teacher, he wasn't always someone that was, you know, devoted to worship or God, but he's kind of manipulating his flock. And, you know, it's in the time of famine. So they're hungry, they're desperate, they're in this kind of state of pain. It's become a kind of cult commune situation. And it does feel somewhat episodic within the show, where it's like mm-hmm. another adventure that mostly Ellie has in this episode, because Joel is sick. He is basically, you know,
has an infection from his
family. And so she's trying to look for medicine and figure out like what to do next, and if she has to do this alone or does she go back to find Tommy. Like these are all things that, you know, she's considering at this moment. And the two paths of these, you know, of Ellie and also these other characters that were introduced in the beginning of the episode collide when they're hunting for a deer, mm-hmm. and how that plays out. There's this kind of interesting back and forth between Scott Shepherd and Bella Ramsey's characters, where, you know, they're basically testing each other and seeing who's the more dominant force. And it becomes kind of a dialogue or a game of manipulation. You know, and how, you know, Ellie can get what she needs and she's a little bit more forthright about what she wants and, you know, stern. But David, you can tell, is trying to be both friendly and inviting in the way that a minister or a priest would be. But there's something about the way that Scott Shepherd plays it where you can tell also it's very unnerving and you just kind of feel completely unsettled by him. And I think Scott Shepherd is one of those great character actors that can play, like most recently he was in Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. He played DiCaprio's brother in that.
Oh, right.
And he was in Bridge of Spies. He's worked with a ton of really great filmmakers, and he's always kind of like authoritarian, sort of figures within those worlds. Even Kelly Reichardt's First Cow, he's got a really interesting kind of face and almost like a folksy kind of vibe to him. But then also he can be someone like, you know, you can put him in a suit and he can be a bureaucrat.
Yeah.
Here he plays kind of like the last vestige of, you know, like sanity slowly sinking into, you know, this kind of darker terrain and kind of being more impulsive and giving into, you know, the darker side of human nature. And yeah. As we are discovering, you know, it's basically a story about cannibals.
Yes.
You know, some and people know, some people don't within the community. And that's yeah, and the story.
And even watching this now the third time and knowing from the game, and I kind of knew all that stuff going in, and it's really kind of fun to see the subtle character moments where they slowly reveal that with, you know, even Troy Baker's James, kind of the look he gives him when they talk about why can't you bury the dad and all that kind of stuff is like, which
because we got to eat him.
Yeah. So, I like what you mentioned about it being kind of an Ellie episode, and this is kind of her fucked up coming of age moment in the series, right? Because all the time before this, she's always relied on Joel, right? Like she was always, this is kind of her, you know, becoming, it sounds gross, but like becoming a woman moment in the sense of her, or an adult kind of, even though she's still a teenager, because she has to kind of fend for herself and use everything she's kind of learned from Joel. And now she cares about him and they develop this relationship where she wants to save him and she doesn't know if she can do it on her own. And she kind of has to go through this thing with David on her own throughout the whole thing. So I think that's really interesting from Ellie's perspective. We're finally kind of, she has to go do this without Joel, which I think is really interesting.
She has to pick it up in herself.
Yes, exactly.
Faith in one man, you know,
yes,
like that's
exactly
the story or the conflict here between both David and Ellie, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's faith in the individual. It's faith in, you know, yourself, but then it's also, it's like putting your faith in someone to lead you to prosperity or safety is something that is, you know, it can be very vulnerable. It can be, you know, a gamble in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I think with this community, even though they know that David can be abusive, as we see in that first scene, and how we see, like, you know, the one girl still crying about her father and how he treats her in front of everybody, there's still that feeling of like, oh, well, we have picked this person to be our representative, our leader. And nobody is going to say anything because they're afraid.
Yeah.
What does that sound like to you?
So to jump back, we pick up with Ellie kind of tending to Joel's wounds in the basement of this house that she's kind of hiding out in. So Joel did survive. He seems to be on death's door. He's got this infection in his kind of his abdomen. Ellie doesn't know what to do. But she knows that she has to go out and get food for herself, but also to try and keep Joel alive as well. So she goes out and hunts a deer. So she tracks the deer, shoots the deer. And then that's where, you know, after she tracks the deer, after she shot it, she meets up with James and David. So they kind of collide in this moment where James and David see the wounded deer and they're going to take it, but then Ellie confronts them. And another thing you mentioned of the back and forth between Ellie and David in this moment, I think it's interesting because you can also tell that Ellie's not quite comfortable with all of this yet either. Like you can kind of tell in Bella Ramsey's performance, it feels like she's putting on a little bit. Like I don't know if she actually believes she's tough in these moments or has to act tough. And even the way that she delivers a lot of these lines, I kind of see it as someone who's a bit of a poser in those moments, but has learned that you kind of have to do this to kind of survive in this world. And
well, the character's feeling it out, right?
Yeah.
Like the character is realizing in this moment, Ellie is realizing that this is a fight or flight kind of situation. And to everything you were saying before, where, you know, she's learned all this stuff from Joel as they've, you know, made this trek. And now she has to take what she's learned and what she, you know, is, you know, thinking about this way and having to apply it in a real world situation. And being on your own, you don't have anybody else to rely on. And every move you make could be life or death. It's a survival situation. It's basically, you know, every decision you make will have consequences or ramifications to, you know, that choice. And so she's feeling out the scene while she's keeping, the character is keeping her guard up. And what I like about the performance in that scene and what, you know, they're doing is how we see, you know, a kind of, you know, a sternness in that this character knows exactly what is needed and what the character has to do in this situation, and is get the medicine and, you know, save.
Well, it immediately clicks for her when she sees other people that they might have this to trade, right?
Yes. So, you know, the character knows exactly what's on the line, is that Joel, you know, his life hangs in the balance, and it probably, you know, the more time she spends talking or bargaining, you know, the less chance that Joel could pull through. And so, you know, like every, you know, word, every moment you take, it just lessens the chance of someone making it through a situation, especially in this, you know, it's cold, it's, you know, the infection isn't being treated by anything. So the more time you spend, the less you have on actually, you know, saving someone. So I think the character's principles and what they're trying to do is there. It's just more
absolutely.
You know, like, this is the first time that this character, like you were saying,
had to do this, right?
So, on their own.
Exactly. So that's what I mean by the kind of the confidence is, it feels shaky a little bit, but then also she, like you just said, knows what she needs to do and has to kind of say it no matter what. So yeah, she bargains with David and James, saying, I will give you this deer if you get me some medicine. So David says that they have penicillin back at the camp that they're staying at, or the resort that they're at. So he sends James to go get the penicillin and then waits there with Ellie. David mentions that it's going to take, you know, it's 4 miles, I think he says, each way. So it's going to take a while for James to go back and come back. So he goes, why don't we go inside this, cabin that is nearby and take the deer. And he has a lantern and can start a fire or something like that. So they go inside. David and Ellie, you know, Ellie still has the gun. She takes all the bullets out of their guns and is sitting with her gun on her lap, talking to David. They kind of have this conversation back and forth. Like you mentioned, they're kind of feeling each other out, sort of, I think, in this moment. You've already kind of described it.
And what makes David so dangerous is because he's not a man of faith.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily, like, you know, he talks about discovering God
after the apocalypse.
And to me, that almost feels like something that, say, like J.D. Vance would say, where it's like he's more of an opportunist than he is truly a man of faith or belief in any way, where it's like, okay, well, I can manipulate people, you
to
know,
do what
to
I kind of want myself to survive longer, right?
And he's smart enough because he has an educated background where he can take people that maybe don't have that and, you know, twist their thoughts and their minds in a way.
Does he say he's a
cult.
School teacher? Is
yes.
that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is even more fucked up with what happens later. So,
hey man, school teachers are underpaid.
Yeah, God. So
and
they
I just like
this...
the idea quickly of, like, as all of this is going on, what probably really is happening with, like, Pedro Pascal is that he's shooting one of his 9 other projects that he's working on.
So they have to do this episode where he's kind of not in it for a little bit.
Yeah.
That's why they did episode 3 as well. He randomly wears a helmet for the whole series. So they have this kind of back and forth. And then through this dialogue, you get kind of a fun reveal with David. He kind of puts together who Ellie is and who she might be with. And then there's a reveal from, you know, we already mentioned that there's a man that was killed earlier when they were going out to look for food. That was the father of the young girl in the first scene. And then it's revealed here that that is one of the men Joel killed at the university, because David puts it together that this crazy man who killed some of his people was with a young girl at the school. And that kind of gets revealed during this conversation. So as that happens, James returns at that exact moment. David kind of says, put the gun down to James, because James is pointing the gun at Ellie. and kind of for some reason keeps his people from killing Ellie and kind of wants to let her go and take the medicine. Basically not sort of using her as bait, I think, to try to find Joel. Right. And then still knows that Ellie is kind of innocent in this, situation, but then, you know, we'll see later that he had ulterior motives as well. So, which is gets creepier and grosser too. So, he lets Ellie go with the penicillin. So, and then James is confused and he's like, don't worry, we'll find them later kind of thing. So Ellie then, I think we cut to Ellie going back to Joel, right?
Yeah.
So she goes down, injects the penicillin.
She doesn't even know where exactly to inject it.
Yeah.
But she's, because again, like the character is not a doctor, has never had any training in that way. So like even watching how the character, you know, even just like takes the penicillin and where to put it, it's that's fascinating because usually in most TV shows or movies, once the character gets, you know, the vaccine, they're usually like, oh, I'll just, you know, pull it out of the formula and I'll tap the needle and I'll stick it exactly where it needs to go. And I like that this actually takes some time to be like, oh, well, yeah, she's not a doctor. She's not a nurse. She's not, it doesn't have any medical background. So this is basically, you know, a lucky situation in terms of how everything works out. But, you know, there's not a lot of movies and TV shows that actually take the time to do that, where, you know, somebody that is just literally flying by the seat of their pants in hope for the best gets it right, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know if there's a wrong place to inject penicillin. I know you're allergic, so am I. So
yeah. Well, I mean, we would be dead.
Yeah, we'll see.
Anaphylactic shock.
Exactly. That would be, yeah. She doesn't know Joel's allergic to penicillin. She's like, fuck. So she injects him with the penicillin. Actually, I'll get to my thoughts on kind of this episode at the end too, because I was going to jump into a point about this foreshadowing kind of the final episode and Joel's decision and things like that, of Ellie kind of the whole vaccine and then Joel saving. Yeah, we'll get to there in the next episode. But then they have this kind of quite beautiful moment where, you know, there's always this kind of, you know, father-daughter relationship kind of throughout the whole series. And they kept getting closer and closer each episode. But I think this episode really kind of, what I just mentioned, solidifies Joel's choices in the next episode and really kind of as his, you know, surrogate kind of daughter, and where she kind of cuddles up with him. And as, you know, she gives him the medicine and kind of sleeps beside him overnight. So then we cut back to David's camp. And I think this is where we kind of get the reveal. The cannibalism thing isn't confirmed until, you know, Ellie sees the ear when she's locked up, which we'll get to in a second.
But you know something's up. When, like, yes, where'd they get all that food and
that,
like,
deer meat, the deer meat.
Deer meat, in quotations. And
exactly. So I think, again, unsuspecting people, I still think you probably don't realize. You might go, that's, everyone's acting a little bit weird. But you probably don't realize until the ear thing that they're eating people. But you do kind of see them cooking this stew, and someone comes up from downstairs and brings this big kind of thing of meat, and they go, oh, where'd we get that? Because at this point David and James had not returned with the deer that Ellie shot. So they're like, oh, we had leftover venison. Like, and everyone's like, we were just talking this morning that we had no food left, and like, or only had a little bit. So that, you kind of see everyone going, okay. And then knowing, even the first time I watched this, knowing exactly, you're like, oh, gross. Everyone's just eating this stew in this room. And like, you know exactly what's happening.
I think
happening.
If you're a genre fan, you kind of know what's going on at that point. Because I mean, like, even like the way that they pay close attention to not only the eating, but the food itself and how it's prepared and how it's plated. These things kind of tell you through visual language what is going on.
And even the setting, and yeah, the setting. Most apocalyptic stories have, you know, the road and, you know, many things that The Last of Us is kind of even based off of have cannibalistic elements and stuff like that. Because it's just, I think, a very natural thing to explore.
Natural thing to explore in life, but yeah,
in an apocalyptic situation.
There's also the really great underrated pioneer horror movie called Ravenous with Guy Pearce that also kind of looks at that, but it's not in the post-apocalypse. It's during like a pioneer time, and it's a bit of an oddity. And then also, you know, you look at Cannibal the Musical, right? You know, like that. I mean, he's mocking it, obviously, but like there's the voyage of time. You know, like when settlers first came to a new land, that's where you had cannibalism, and then it's the end of the world where all the resources are gone, and basically you're just eating each other.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry. I'm just messaging my wife back. Yeah, it's gross, but I definitely understand. So at this point we go to the dining hall where everyone's eating this human stew. And David and James come back with the deer and say that they caught a deer. They killed a deer. So they'll have food for the next little while. Everyone's kind of eating. James or someone else is like hesitant to eat because like they know what's going on, right? Like
they know what it is. Yeah.
So I think they're kind of and then.
But it goes back to the series as a whole, right? Because Joel has talked about before how you've done things in the past in order to survive that you're not proud of, and that you've probably hurt people, and you're, you know, in one timeline or another, you're the hero of a story, but then you're a villain in another. Yeah. So,
which we will explore in season two, baby. I cannot wait for that. That'll be a large topic of conversation in season two. So David comes back, and then the young woman from the opening sequence, they mentioned Ellie, or he knows that rumors have already kind of spread that they found this girl who has this connection to the man that killed the guy they reference in the opening, who is the father of this young girl. So the young girl kind of speaks up against David and says we should kill Ellie and Joel, basically saying like, you're wrong, we should do it this way, because he's the one who said we should keep her alive, or maybe she can be of use to us if we integrate her into our community and things like that. So this is where his kind of
neither choice is Christian, or neither choice is like God-fearing. Like it's basically personal, indulgence on David's part, and we'll come to see what that is as we move along. But then also, you know, it's revenge. And so like that also shows you how, you know, the religious outlook of things, because most religions are built on the idea of charity and compassion and kindness for others, you know, but in a world where there is no hope, and you know, faith is still providing some people with some form of comfort in terms of knowing maybe or thinking there's an afterlife or something more to this world, or we're being tested in a situation, and the leftovers in this case are not HBO's The Leftovers, but the leftovers of dear old dad from the last episode.
She's probably eating right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's just interesting in terms of how little character moments, because we don't get to know a lot of the people within the community. Yeah. And so moments like that kind of help give you an idea of like, you know, this girl is only human and she's still following a faith that probably initially started as something as being about peace and is now, you know, talking about killing two people, you know, to avenge her father.
And then the irony of him using violence and fear to kind of manipulate and control everyone, right? Like he goes over
to dominate.
He goes over and slaps this young girl and says like, don't you ever talk back to me, essentially, like I'm the one in charge. And
and that's the scene I was talking about. I thought it was earlier on, but it's now, and that's where it's like this has probably happened before, but like people probably know that David is capable of violence, but they're not saying or doing anything to counter that, you know? And so like this kind of very out in the open, violence and sadism is basically, accepted because I think everybody fears David or fears what could happen to them. And I almost wonder how many people do really know what the food is, and they're just telling themselves otherwise because they just don't want to believe it.
Yeah, I'd say that there's probably the way that he even knows that how information spreads quickly within the group, right?
Like, yeah, because if they know that there's a girl there that, you know, and the guy, like, okay.
That means James went back and fucking opened his stupid mouth right away.
Yeah. And it also says, like, okay, well then, like, how would they not know that they're eating somebody, even if it's not in this particular case? Maybe there was an incident before.
Depending on how many people are involved, because we do see that scene we'll get to later where Joel sees all the bodies strung up in the cold to keep them from rotting and stuff like that, right?
Yeah. But it's a pioneer thing too, right? Because they didn't have refrigerators, or they don't have refrigerators.
They don't have power,
so they usually freeze them or they put them like in salt. I'm not talking about human bodies in this case. I'm talking about, like, you know, fur trappers,
animals. Sure. So then he reveals to everyone that they'll go after Joel because he's the man who killed them. But Ellie, he wants alive to bring back to their community. So David and his men go out to find Ellie. I think at this point, Ellie goes out. She was going to go hunting again, I think, on the horse, or does she hear them or something? I forget. But
they're following the tracks, right?
Because it's all in the snow.
She's leading them. Yeah.
So they find out kind of where Ellie is. She gets out of the house before they find Joel, because I think in her mind is that they're going to probably find her, but she doesn't want to lead them to Joel because Joel is still basically almost in a coma. Like, he's still in the basement, barely able to move.
He's still shooting his other 9 movies.
Exactly. So she goes out on the horse, kind of shoots her gun off and lures them away to chase her. James then kind of chases after Ellie. He shoots her horse. Ellie kind of falls off the horse and is dazed. James and the other men of David's crew are about to kill Ellie. And then David stops them from doing that and wants to take her back to their compound, kind of thing. So at this point, Joel's still not awake, right? Like, they're still looking for Joel, but they take Ellie back to the resort.
He's kind of coming in and out of consciousness at this point. Like, cause I think
he can kind of hear what's going on outside.
But yeah. The medicine is working, but it's still, like, you know, slow. He's groggy. He's out of it. But I just want to go back to Ellie falling off the horse. I think, like, that's an important thing here because it makes sense, because this character is still in a place where she's learning. And even though she's learned a lot since episode one, the character isn't Rambo or Arnold Schwarzenegger or John Wick. And what I always find really odd about those movies, and I was watching this and this also dates the episode now, because watching A Working Man, it's like you create these people that are indestructible, but then you have to have, like, a scene where the villain gets the better of them.
Yeah.
And I never believe it for an instant that everything else you've shown me in the movie, the character gets out of the situation and dispatches the villains so quickly. You know, like with A Working Man, there's a scene where Jason Statham's character, who's, like, literally destroyed every single person he's come into contact with up until these two kind of goofy Russian brothers put him in the back of a van, and, like, they got him, you know? And you're just like, no, it's the same thing with John Wick when, like, you know, the house invasion in the first movie happens. And it's like, okay, so you're telling me that this moment here is, you know, he couldn't get out of the situation and couldn't save the dog.
Now he can kill 300 people.
And you could argue, oh, well, in John Wick's case, he's rusty. But it's like, okay, well, if he's rusty, why wasn't it more like Nobody when Bob Odenkirk was kind of, like, slowly getting back into things? Like, for the most part, everything else in that movie in John Wick feels like, okay, he's just ready to go. What I like about this, going back to The Last of Us, is that, okay, you know, Ellie's not a crime fighter or action hero.
Not at all, yeah.
And, you know, for that to happen to the character and for the character to eventually be captured, there's more believability there. There's more suspense there than, say, watching, you know, even another movie like this, where you put, like, a you know, a big name actor in this role, you know, they're going to be fine. And you know that it's like you're just waiting for, you know, the next beat to happen where they, you know, they untie themselves. Well,
she's a young girl too, right? So like it's I think being a young woman and with all these men kind of I think adds a layer of kind of unsettling and an unsettling nature. And you
well, they're predators, yeah, right? Exactly. In that way, like David will come to know as like truly a horrible, heinous predator, but they're different types of predators. Like some of them are predators in the sense of, you know, they want vengeance and so they want to kill. Some of them want to eat. So those yeah. are predators. David's specificity of a predator is probably the most loathsome of the bunch in terms of, you know, what we're thinking of in terms of what we need to survive or who we are as people. You know, we talk about a wolf hiding in sheep's clothing. David is that, you know, David yes. very much is the monster pretending he is the good person. And I think that's also just an interesting aspect of this episode.
And even if you know that there's a Last of Us Part II video game where you've seen Ellie on the cover, you still, I don't think it's this. I agree with you that it's not the same where you never feel like she's in danger or anything like that, because even this whole thing, like incredibly traumatic things happen to this young girl, right? To my point earlier of her having to kind of this coming of age moment, this really fucked up having to now, you know, we'll get to it, brutally murder this dude to kind of escape his kind of fucked up, you know, like you said, predatory kind of things that he's doing. So I agree with you that it's not like you think, oh, well, Joel and Ellie are the lead characters. Like, you know that everything's going to be okay. I feel like the show does a great job of not knowing what the hell is going to happen each episode, and any character can kind of go at any point. So then this leads perfectly into what you're saying of Ellie wakes up in a cage at David's resort. And
come to David's resort. Yeah.
She wakes
We've
up in
got
a cage,
five-star dining,
and realizes, you know, he says it's like, oh, we're just doing it because, like, I to protect you right now, kind of thing. But she's like, you put me in a fucking cage. And then they have this back and forth where he kind of reveals that he wants her to be his like child bride, kind of, and not
Going
kind
back
of
to the pioneer time.
I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he says. He's like, oh, I see. I need an equal. I want you to be with me. Like, we could. And it's just very strange and very weird and very uncomfortable. And this is where we learn that, you know, it's explicitly shown that they're resorting to cannibalism, because Ellie sees the ear. She sees full res dogs on the ground. And
lend
then,
me your ear, Kirk Blitz.
So
who's the cop in Reservoir Dogs?
So he kind of they have this kind of back and forth, and she basically tells him to go fuck himself and that she's gonna kill him or whatever, and like she's gonna get out of there, and he kind of leaves her there. Then we cut back to Joel, who now, or the men are kind of closing in on Joel, right? We cut back to David's men who are searching for Joel. They're going through house to house, door to door, to kind of find him. Then we see a man who goes into the house where Joel and Ellie were, goes down to the basement. You think he's going to see, you know, Joel in a coma on the ground. And, you know, I love the show. And I love Joel.
This is where the cliche.
Yeah. This is like, I love the video game. I love the show. But this is where you're like, that penicillin worked pretty quickly. And you're like, and I know a penicillin can work quickly and it would help the infection, but this man goes from being on death's door to absolutely murdering everyone. And it's not John Wick-esque. He's still, you know, pretty slow.
But it still feels almost like an action cliche where it's like, you know, it's a fake out moment, right? Where it's like, you know, you've been told that this is where Joel has been the whole episode, and he's in a really bad state right now. And so when we have these characters coming in and it's like, oh no, you're creating suspense. I think most people kind of know, like it's going to be fine for him. But sure. like the way that it does it, it does feel like, okay, this is where we are falling into like a trope
and a
here.
Suspension like, of disbelief moment where you're like, okay, I guess I can believe that the penicillin worked enough where he would have enough energy to overpower seven dudes and stab them all in the back of the neck and stuff like that. And like,
well, he hasn't eaten anything in a long time as well, right? Because calories are important in terms of, you know, like the more you burn off calories in terms of fighting off an illness, sure. like how much energy do you have?
I totally agree. Anything? But it is one of those things you're like, all right, well, I guess I'll let it pass kind of thing. You're just like, it's not that big of a deal, but it does have that moment of going, okay, he was literally looking like he was on death's door 2 seconds ago. So he goes and starts killing these guys one by one. Do we get the, I think we just go straight into the interrogation scene, right? Which is one of the more brutal scenes of the series. So Joel, after killing a bunch of David's men, captures two of them. We then open up on a scene where Joel has one man tied to a chair and another man kind of tied up in the corner, I believe. Right.
Yeah. I'm in the corner watching you kill him.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and absolutely, we see Joel's kind of brutal side. And I think because he's been with Ellie for most of the series, we've seen Joel be brutal in other moments. But I feel like this is that Joel that we skipped over in between the moment Sarah, his daughter, died and when we meet him in the series, because there's this whole gap in his history where we know he did some pretty fucked up stuff and he wasn't a great guy. And
he's desperate.
And
he doesn't want to lose another daughter.
Exactly. So he interrogates both these men. It just starts right off the bat of him just fucking stabbing one guy in the kneecap and like tied to the chair and just goes, tell me where we are and tell me where Ellie's be, where you took Ellie essentially. And it better be the exact same two points on this map that your friend over there tells me, or I'm going to kill you. So then the guy, he puts the knife in the dude's mouth that's all bloody at the end, and he pokes the parts where Joel is supposed to go to find Ellie. And then, you know, in a typical interrogation scene, you double check the information with the other guy. No, he just straight up fucking stabs the one guy in the heart. And then the other guy's like, what the fuck, man? Like, no. And like, and then he goes, I believe him. And then just fucking bashes his brain in with like a lead pipe. So pretty crazy.
Joel just, you know, that penicillin just went, you know,
exactly,
got into him.
Yeah.
And he was just like, you know what? I'm going to trade. That would be funnier. Like if it was a comedy, we'd just be like, oh, I'll just take these dead bodies and trade them for Ellie. Cause now David's got food for the rest of the winter.
Well, then you go, yeah. Like if people didn't die of natural causes, like, is he killing the people off in his community? Is that part
I'm
of
sure
it?
Sure. He's probably, or like maybe somebody that is sick or, you know, like there's that story about the lottery where every year, not that it's about feeding somebody, but it's about sacrifice in order to, you know,
for the greater good,
about routine and ritual, right? Where like one person every year has to be stoned to death by picking, you know, the unlucky number from the bin, and it doesn't matter who it is, but it also seems archaic because nothing happens, but you do it anyways. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason for doing it here because it's about surviving, it's about feeding yourself, but there's also the feeling of like, okay, these characters, you know, are so submissive to David that either, like, I we were talking about it before, I really do think there probably are more people that do know what's going on, but just either
you have to, I think, right, by the
just don't care because they just want to save themselves, and so in order to do that, it's like, okay, well, I'll eat whatever or I'll play along because I don't want to be the one that is being eaten next week.
Exactly,
if I say anything, you know,
that's exactly it. I forgot to mention that Ellie does break David's finger in that sequence as well. So he reaches in and
she does.
Busts his finger, and then a great performance by Bella Ramsey, just screaming at him as he leaves the room.
A good finger break. It's pretty visceral. Oh, yeah. Like, I think that's actually more effective than like pulling out someone's nails.
Yeah.
In
when you see
scene.
The
like,
finger think... just go sideways as someone's doing it. And it's a great effect to do because it's probably pretty easy to do.
Even in comedy, like a show we'll be talking about know, coming up soon.
Yeah. God. So Ellie then, so David and James come in and because Ellie's not complying with his weird, predatory, pedophilic kind of weirdo, you know, child bride.
You're waiting for David Hansen to come in and to say, you know, to catch a predator.
Yeah. So James and David pull Kelly out of Ellie out of the cage, and attempt to strap her on the table where they have seemingly be butchering the other people to eat. So you assume that that's what they're going to do with her.
Soylent Green situation. Yeah. Here we go.
Ellie is able to kind of fight them off, grab the butcher knife from David, stab it into James' neck. So that's a wrap on the original Joel, Troy Baker's cameo. James has a butcher knife in his neck. And then she kind of fights off David and runs into the cabin or kind of the resort lodge kind of thing, right? Yes. A fire has started. I forget how the fire starts. Do you remember? I think just someone knocks over one of the pots or something like that.
That usually is another kind of cliche kind of thing in these movies or TV shows where there's a fight and usually something is knocked over and it starts a fire or something collapses. It's usually in the moment, unless it's deliberate.
Yeah.
In this case, I think it was by accident.
Yeah. I forget exactly what happens, but it's a pretty iconic. So this,
where's everybody else at this point though? Like that's thing I was kind of questioning, like where are the other villagers?
I'm assuming like, because you know, this is a big, like resort, that this lodge is where they've secretly kept the, you know, dead people to butcher and stuff like that. And maybe it's not a place most people go or anything like that, but it does seem like that's where they're cooking thing.
Well, I thought that's where they were all going to eat.
Yeah. I thought like, so. Maybe like, too, but like maybe a communion where almost. They go to eat and they're, it's not lunchtime yet or dinner time. So they're just somewhere else. I don't know. There's not, it doesn't seem like there's like a lot of them. Right. But
no, but there's a fair there was amount. Enough to be yeah. like
it's not yeah. like Jackson or anything that we see with Tommy and stuff like that, at least at this point. So this is a for people who played the game know, but in the game this is one of the biggest kind of it sounds corny to put it in this way, but boss fights, like boss battles in the game.
Like, not the final like, boss like no, The Rock.
David is one of the most iconic, you know, boss things, because in the game the building's on fire and you kind of have this grid like sequence where you have to sneak around and there's broken glass on the ground. So if Ellie and this was a big deal in the game because you're playing as Ellie, the rest of the video game you've been playing as Joel. So when Joel's incapacitated in the game, it's slightly different than in the show. You think he's dead because this whole time, you know, you've been playing as Ellie and it's not revealed that Joel's alive until a bit later. But it's an iconic boss fight where you have to kind of run around and distract David and throw something to distract him and come up with him and get a couple shots on him. And then very similar in the show, just condensed. You have Ellie kind of fight him off.
And how does he look in the video game version?
He looks like, oh my God. The actor, why am I blanking?
David Desmulchin?
No. I have an exact actor in my head that he looks exactly like, and my brain is mush, but I'm going to have John Hawks. He looks like
John Hawks.
He looks just like John Hawks, and he's played by Nolan North in the game, who is from another Naughty Dog Drake. Video game, Nathan Drake from Uncharted. So that was kind of the, you know, Troy Baker, Nolan North kind of in this very dark, fucked up kind of thing in this. So he looks exactly like John Hawks. Like John Hawks would have been perfect if you're casting exactly how they look in the game, but right. And even sounds like him and stuff. They definitely, I think, based it off John Hawks. At least that was always my thinking. So we have this moment where Ellie fights off David. I do like this.
Well, did we miss the part where like she kind of confuses him for a minute where she tells David that he's infected?
Yes, because... sorry, that was on the table. Sorry, thank you for that clarification. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Eric. So I skimmed over that. How she fights them off is that she tells them she is infected. So it kind of confuses them in the moment because they're about to kill her and want to eat her. And she's saying, you shouldn't eat me because I'm infected. And then shows them the bite on her arm. They're a bit confused, being like, she would have turned by now. Why hasn't she turned? And she uses that to her advantage. And then that's how she gets the butcher knife and kills James. So thank you. Yes, Eric, that's a great point. Yeah. But she does fight off David. Again, I like that they just let, this is Ellie's moment. She has to do this herself. Like, Joel doesn't come in and save the day or anything like that. But you can tell that he really cares and he's trying to find her. David is going to kill. Ellie actually causes the fire, I think, to distract David. Like, it's kind of to make him be like, it just makes it harder for him to find her. And I think that's the same in the game. And then they have this brutal confrontation where he's this man who's pinned down this young girl, and he says a bunch of really creepy shit. And he says this is the part he enjoys the most and stuff like that. And you're like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? And then she ends up being able to take the butcher knife, which is just out of her reach. And she repeatedly basically caves his head in
carves him.
Yeah, with this butcher knife. And I respect the show for being very brutal and very violent, but not resulting in like an unnecessary kind of splatter fest, gore fest. Like, it's very visceral. It's very
disturbing. It's not a Grindhouse movie.
Exactly. Like, you don't necessarily need to see the gore of her doing this, but it's off screen and the blood does a lot of the work on her face as she's this intense performance, killing David. And, you know, it is this moment. She's a young girl through, like, I think, is this her first kill? Or is, yeah, I think so, right? Because I think doesn't she shoot someone maybe in an earlier scene, but Joel maybe stops her. I'm a little bit fuzzy, but I think.
Yeah, because Joel has done most of, sort of like, he's kind of shielded her as much as he can, or at least he's kind of kept her from, like, she's seen
there's the moment
in
Pittsburgh, right? Wasn't there like where she had, like, I remember the moment in Pittsburgh as they're fighting off people, or I might be wrong, but.
Well, I mean, at least it's not as, and somebody listening to this, if they're listening to this, will correct us, but it's not as close quarters.
Yes, it's
right?
Not as,
like, it's not.
Yes, she might have shot, like, someone, but I forget if this was her first kill or if it's just this moment where she's in this world and she has to fend for herself and it's brutal and violent and she has to do this herself and this is the only way she feels like she can get out of this situation. And
she's actually causing someone else pain to the point of ending their life. She's seen horrible things before this,
but she's, like, never had to commit them herself, I think. No, so I think this is, being a young woman, like a very obviously traumatic turning point in her life, I think, right? So
Just realizing that this is what the real world is now, right? Because she has lived, this character has lived in, you know, an academy setting and been sort of brainwashed to believe one thing and protected by sort of a gated community for so long that, you know, over the course of this journey, she has seen a lot of death and destruction and the horrors that humanity has to offer, but hasn't been the one that necessarily has, you know, inflicted that pain on somebody else or has ended somebody else's life in that way that is so, you know, visceral and just, like, you know, you feel it because you are, like, it's not like, you know, if you're shooting somebody, it's still awful, but at least there's distance, right? Yeah. Where this is, like, literally you are, like, carving into somebody, you are stabbing somebody to death. So, you know, this is, you know, you said coming of age moment. It's a moment of realizing this is what the world is.
Exactly.
You know, and this is not what she learned in the manuals and texts and, like, her training. Nothing can prepare her. Nothing can prepare Ellie for any
of the horrors of what this world actually, like, brings and things like that. So Ellie stumbles out of the cabin, or lodge, as it's on fire after killing David. And then Joel finds her as she's kind of disoriented because of this thing that she just had to do. And Joel holds her, and I believe this is the first time he calls her baby girl, which is, I think, what he called his daughter, Sarah. So I think it was, like, solidifies kind of this father-daughter kind of bond that they have.
And it was also to let you know that that's one movie he was not in, Baby Girl.
Yes, that came out in the couple year gap in between these two episodes that we've done. So yeah, I think a great like moment between the two. And I think like everything kind of builds to, you know, this penultimate episode of them solidifying this bond. And I think this moment of Ellie going through all of this, even just to save Joel, I think solidifies some of the things we're going to see in the next episode and obviously into season two. So it kind of,
well, Ellie can also maybe understand now a little bit more of where Joel's coming from. You know, maybe she doesn't always still agree with like his methods or his tactics, but you know, given the number of years Joel has been doing this and has been surviving and having to make life or death decisions that are not morally, you know, that are morally questionable, it feels as though like maybe Ellie now at least can not even relate, but just it's like, okay, she has a better understanding of like what people are like in this world. And you know, you have to have your guard up, or you know, you can't trust really anybody, because there is this feeling of Ellie throughout this whole story has been a little bit more open to accepting people, or you know, at least creating a dialogue or discussion with them, where Joel is someone where he's like, keep to yourself, keep moving, you know, don't get involved anywhere or with anyone, or even try to, you know, make contact.
Yeah.
And so after all of this, you know, you wonder how significant of a role this is going to play, not only in the finale, which we have already seen, but you know, this is really kind of going to shape that character moving forward, you know, in terms of how the character approaches violence and trust and community. And so like, it's an impactful episode in that way. And even though it is, we were talking before, like it's episodic and that it's like, it's another kind of like,
but still very character focused, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you never feel like it's just like simply like plot driven, or it's telling you, you know, you have to get, like if it was more plot driven, it would have Ellie having maybe to do more things in order to get the penicillin, you know, it'd be like, oh, you have to do this. And in order to barter with this person, you have to get them this because they want that. And that's where almost it would be like gameplay, right? Yeah. Where it's like, you know, you're trading things or you're having to do other side missions in order to get the thing that you need. It's all based on like, okay, the character is coming into their own. They're figuring out now that this is what the reality of the world is, in what, you know, Joel has been talking about this whole time, and how he's always very much, you know, stoic and grizzled and broken. And you kind of understand like, yeah, like if you have survived this long, you probably have done something or a series of things that you're not particularly, you know, proud about in terms of, you know, having to survive. But it's not a time or a world where you can simply go to therapy or, you know, talk to somebody. Like you just basically bottle it up and move on, and it's probably screwed up everybody that is a survivor. Like I wouldn't be surprised if every single person in, you know, the camp that Tommy's in have done things in their past. Like every character feels like, you know, they probably have their own stories in terms of how they got to where they are, and they're probably not all pleasant.
And they all have reasons for why they did things too, right? And that kind of will come into play. And that your past doesn't just, you know, your past will always come back, right?
And, it always comes back to haunt you in some way or another. Or it's like the whole thing of karma, right? You know?
I thought it was a great episode. I thought Scott Shepherd, excellently cast. A wonderful kind of guest appearance, which the show has done such a good job with, of like having, you know, kind of these one-off, you know, guest appearances from people, and everyone being excellent in those roles. So whether they're from the game, like Troy Baker, I thought did a great job as James, you know, kind of a smaller, you know, subdued kind of performance, but holds his own. And for people who know that that's Joel from the games, that's kind of fun. And Scott Shepherd's great, and Bella Ramsey just absolutely crushes it in this episode. So I thought it was a great penultimate episode and to a lot of the points you just said,
penultimate or penicillin.
Yeah. Sets up a lot of the themes that we explore, not only in the finale, but moving forward as well. I really do think it's a turning point for that character and how she kind of,
it's Ellie's episode. Yeah. It really is. Like like Ellie has always been present and beside Joel through this whole thing, but this is where, and I guess because of where we're going, I mean, I haven't played the game, but I know where The Last of Us 2 is going. And maybe if the creators of this show or of the video game maybe had early ideas of doing a sequel, you know, you have to establish, well, Ellie has to move past Joel, right? And move on and move in her own direction.
Yeah, so, I'm assuming they knew they wanted her to be the playable character in part two, and then teasing that with her being playable in the video game, this being an episode where she has her first brutal kill, right? And then also her being the main character, which moving forward, it kind of does, you know, obviously Joel and Ellie are equal parts in this story, but it does, after this moment, start to tend more towards Ellie and her being the lead, where Joel is more of a supporting role, right? But we'll see that in the finale, and then we'll, no spoilers, obviously we won't spoil anything that happens in Last of Us Part 2. Each episode, we're just going to be talking about what happens in that episode, maybe tease a little things for the next episode. At this point, you all have probably watched season one, and maybe you're catching up, or you're
revisiting it
like we have as well. So you're probably pretty stoked for season two like we are, but we will cover episode 9, the finale of season one, next week, which will be the week before Last of Us Part 2 premieres on HBO and Max and Crave.
It's like no time has passed, right?
Hey, you know what? This is...
We've just gone from season one to season two.
Yeah, I know. I'm jealous of those people. Like my mom, who just watched Severance season one and two. They never watched
the first season. Don't have that
because they haven't waited in real time. I got messages from my mom, and she also watches The Last of Us, so I'm excited for her to watch season two as well. But with Severance, there was a 3-year gap in between season one and season two, and I think season two really took over kind of the cultural kind of zeitgeist and stuff, and everyone was talking about Severance, and then even people who,
and it's a weekly thing too,
right? It is, man. A lot of the shows, White Lotus, Severance, Last of Us, what other shows have been popping off? Everyone says The Pit is amazing.
Adolescence has become a big thing, but Netflix, yeah, like they release everything at once, where like Apple was really smart with Severance, and I think they're the studio as well, where you continually have the show and the cultural, you know, conversation, even
an HBO or the
when
Kings,
it's off air.
Yeah.
You know,
HBO is,
or Max as they're now known as.
I'll still say HBO, but HBO, kind of, they were the appointment viewing on Sunday nights, and they still are, right? So I think when you look at the Apples and even Disney Plus to an extent, you know, Andor's coming back, which I know doesn't give them huge ratings, but I know that there's passionate people who really, really love that show, and we're very excited for it. But like those weekly, you're seeing even with The Pit, which is a Max show, you're seeing it with White Lotus, you're seeing it with Severance, you're seeing this weekly appointment viewing. And we're in like peak TV again right now too, because I've watched so much TV over the last 3 months, because the movies I feel like have been a little lackluster. So
other than Black Bag and Mickey 17,
and Looney Tunes is great too, and stuff like that. But we're in peak TV, going from, you know, White Lotus straight into Last of Us, going from Severance straight into The Studio. Like there's so much really, really good stuff on right now. And this is making me very excited for Last of Us Part 2. Like going back and watching these final couple episodes, and even though I know the video game inside and out, I know the series, I've watched 2 or 3 times now. So like I know it pretty well, but I'm very excited to jump in and watch season two and kind of do these weekly breakdowns with you. So it'll be very, very exciting. We will complete them this time, and we will do them each week. We're going to aim for Mondays, but because of it airing on Sunday nights and how much we can record beforehand. We'll try to get them out as soon as possible, but you're looking at probably Monday or Tuesdays, something like that. We'll try to get them out. We'd love to get them out Sunday nights for you, but we're having inside baseball stuff of some issues with the screeners. So I don't know how much we're going to be able to pre-record before the season comes out. So we're going to try our best though, but we're going to do one.
We'll do something week. Though. We'll,
oh, we're going to do something. A review for sure. And we're going to do at least episode one's going to be up that Sunday night. It's just moving forward each week. We're going to try to do as many as we can.
You're going to aim for the bushes.
There goes my, anyways, thank you all. We really appreciate it. And we apologize once again for this 2-year gap. I hope you understand that, mentally just wasn't in a great place, but I really do love this show. I really do love the game. It's one of my favorite video games of all time, both part one and part two. One of my favorite universes to talk about. This is one of my favorite shows to do. It just, unfortunately, sometimes you can't control your brain sometimes and had to take a little bit of a break, but, I'm glad to be okay, and I'm glad and excited to be talking about The Last of Us. We'll be back next week, which is April. Oh my God, it's April already. April the 7th will be the next episode that we do next Monday.
In 2026, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. We'll do one episode every 3 years, and we'll finish this when we're on our deathbed later. So I really do appreciate if you guys did come back, or if you're listening for the first time, we really do appreciate it. Go check out our other show, which is called the Untitled Movie Podcast, where Eric and I just kind of review movies. Eric does interviews. We kind of just talk about sometimes trips that we've gone on that have anything tangentially related to movies. We talk about wrestling sometimes. Video games come up a lot. Video game
movies.
Well,
I'm going to mention something.
Please
then,
do.
I have an interview with prosthetic and makeup artist Steve Newburn coming up at the end of April. It won't be until the end of April, but he worked on Until Dawn, but also worked on episode 2 of The Last of Us Infected.
Heck yeah.
So there's a nice tie in there. It's a really good interview. Steve is super nice. He has such an amazing career. He's worked from, worked with everybody from Guillermo del Toro to Martin Scorsese and everyone in between. Chances are you have seen tons of his work. He's responsible for that Hereditary head.
Oh, God, so, really?
Oh, yeah, we get into that. That's something where it's a nice tie-in where, video game adaptations for the most part seem to be having a bit of a renaissance. In terms of quality, I don't know, the commercial aspect has always been there, I think, for a lot of these movies, but in the sense of having a critical success, I think it's because of The Last of Us. I think The Last of Us is the one that broke the code, that figured it out how to, take something that, we're only still starting to see. And I know it's been 2 years, but it does feel like, okay. And we'll talk probably more about IP in the studio, but it does feel like there is this attention now to rebooting video game adaptations in a way that we haven't seen before.
A little bit more faithfully too, right? I think before, it was just a name that they were selling to.
Or not overcomplicating things, or making something, taking a property and turning, like you look at the Super Mario Brothers movie or, Max Payne, and you think to yourself, why did they overdo it? They could have just made a simple action adventure or revenge movie, but you just added too much.
Well, I also think that video game stories are getting better and better, so they're easier to adapt in a sense because the stories are already good, where for a long time it was more the gameplay was what you were there for. And the story was just to kind of piece the gameplay together. And Neil Druckmann even talks about that in a great interview with Alex Garland on the Sony Creator to Creator podcast. He talks about that exact thing. Cause Alex Garland talks about how he's a lover of video games and how he loved The Last of Us show. He thinks it's better than 28 Days Later, and that he's like, and talks about how games for so long were just, you know, this, they weren't, you weren't there for this story. And The Last of
Us, Sony's probably like, don't say that because we have 28 years.
Yeah,
later.
I know, but he talks about obviously that many years have gone by and that he's actually inspired by The Last of Us now, even though The Last of Us was inspired by 28 Days Later. Now, 28 years later is inspired by The Last of Us, right? So it kind of is this full circle kind of thing that they talk about. And now we're a podcast talking about another podcast. But you guys should go check that out if you like this show and if you like Alex Garland's movies, because he is a video game fan, you can tell. And they do talk about not only The Last of Us, but also their new game Intergalactic, The Heretic Prophet. And it's a really fun interview, but that, yeah, they go specifically, Neil Druckmann talks about how, you know, Alex Garland gives him his flowers of saying like The Last of Us was kind of that game for video games to be like, these don't only have to be about a fun gameplay loop, right? Like, you can tell a great story that is emotional and impactful in a different medium. And then there's a lot of other interesting things of how, you know, you adapt a video game to a show or a movie where, you know, a video game inherently you control the pace and you're, you know, it's very different in the way that you have to kind of spread out the story beats because gameplay has to still kind of be first, where in a show you don't necessarily, you know, you don't have to show everything or you don't have to do it in the same way because it's paced so differently. So there's a lot of good stuff there. You guys should check out that as
well. But you can also do things differently within adapting a film or a TV, you know, version of the original source material, because that's something as well that you've talked a lot about on this show, where they have made changes from the game to the series, because it's like, well, why? And this is something I even talked to Steve Newbern about, who's not a video game guy, but he was saying like with Until Dawn, and this is not spoiler or anything, it's just more so like, why would you want to go and see a movie that you know how it's going to play out completely, you know, and like it beat for beat. Like, you don't want just like the one-to-one all the time. You want to see like how this would work in a different medium.
I agree with that. I always push back a little bit because in the sense of, I get what you're saying, and that's a good middle ground, I think. But I always pushed back on the people who were like, well, what is the point if you're just telling the same story? And I go,
well, that's what I mean. But what, like, what is the point of telling this?
I push back because my mom would never play The Last of Us, right? So even if it was
I get that.
But I understand that you wouldn't want to do that anyway. Like, that's not interesting to Neil Druckmann or even Craig Mazin, or to the creators of Until Dawn. I think you again, things play differently on film and on television. And I think that,
well, the mechanics are different, right? From video game.
And again, Neil goes into that whole Bill sequence in the video game and why he did that episode and how it was completely different. And because in the game, you're basically running away from zombies with Bill, and he has all these traps over town, and it was very gameplay focused. Right. And his storytelling was all told through kind of exposition and kind of background stuff. And then, but they could do something different while telling the same Bill story essentially as in the game, but do it in a very different way that had way more impact than the game. And I think even
that was the best episode of that.
It is. It is. And lots of good stuff. I can't wait to talk about the finale. I can't wait to talk about season two. Yes. So rollout, we'll have episode 9, the finale of season 1 next week. In between, I don't know if we can say when embargo is. I forget. I got to read my embargo sheet again.
But we'll just say season 2 is coming soon, and we will be covering it,
and we'll have a review at least of the series of season 1. We're gonna try
at least every year.
Yeah, and then we'll
every week we'll or so.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyways, I cannot wait. One of my favorite things. So we really do appreciate it. Head over to our letterbox, which is Untitled_Movies. Follow us on all those social medias. I'm at Matt Rohrbeck. Eric is EM6211 or Eric Marchin, depending on the social media platform. You can check out all of Eric's interviews and reviews over on RogersTV.com/CinemaScene. Anything else you want to plug, Eric? Or
yeah, just again, be on the lookout. It won't be until the end of April, but the interview with Steve Newbern for Until Dawn is really worthwhile, especially if you are a lover of visual effects and practical effects and makeup. This guy has done it all. He's so kind. There's not an ounce of, you know, there's not like just like even like the slightest bit of arrogance in this guy. Like he should be. He's done so much great work. And so, you know, like if you are a lover of genre filmmaking, of video game adaptations, like this is something to be excited about, because it's rare that you get that much time to talk to somebody about the process of it all and the making of something, and especially that it ties in nicely with video game adaptations and video games in general, but also just with genre filmmaking and a part of film that we don't really have a lot of conversations about, where you don't get to see, you know, the creatives, the artisans talk in this way. Like, you know, he's so open to having a conversation about anything and everything. And so when you do watch it, I think, you know, even if you're not there for, you know, Until Dawn, you'll get something out of it, because he's done so much, and we try to kind of cover a little bit of everything as we're having the conversation.
Awesome. Okay. Until next time.
Would you eat me, Matt, if you had to?
That's such a gross thing to ask. Bye, everybody.